you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
On to today's show, The Winged Victory, Part 2. You're shackled to the float, along with all the prominent Athenians who were captured alive. There are members of the Council of 500, members of the Prytany. There are magistrates and business moguls, former archons, and the city's finest living artists. You're all adorned in luxurious clothes, pulled from wealthy villas. Your neck is weighed down by a collection of gaudy necklaces, obviously from some ostentatious noblewoman's powder room. Above your float is a large painting that depicts the sack of Athens, and hanging from a long rope, like a clothesline, are the vinegar-drenched bodies of the great men who were killed. One of them is your son, Daedalus. You can't look at his shriveled body, but you feel it there. Oh, how you feel it there. Like a cannonball blasting through your chest. The float rumbles through the streets of Rome, pulled by draft horses. There are other floats in the Triumph, each depicting a great moment in General Septimius Calatus's reconquest of Greece. The sack of Sparta, the raising of Delphi, the beheading of the Sacred Band, and, leading them all, the capture of King Mithridates. The old king has been stripped down and is degraded by a patchwork of furs glued to his body so that he looks like a wounded animal. He hangs limply from a large wooden cross that's shaped like an X, spreading his arms and legs. You calculate that the old man must be in his early 80s, but the muscle still rips over his unusually large body. He reminds you of a weightlifter who grew old. He was once a great man, a great king, but now he's broken, just like you. There's a thwack in your temple, and your face feels wet. The smell of rotten egg fills your nostrils. Right, the crowd. They're a pathetic bunch, a screaming, ugly band of poor wretches. They look all strung out and weathery like drug addicts, and they shout and curse at your float. Many hurl rotten food, and by the smell of it, foul unguents saved up from chamber pots. You are almost thankful that Mithridates is in front of your float, as most of the crowd's ammunition is spent before your wagon lumbers past. The crowd cheers behind you. You look back over the railing. You can't see what they're cheering for, but you guess it must be General Calatus following up the procession. You saw a glimpse of him earlier in his magnificent gold chariot, headed by 8 white stallions. He wore the same black toga everyone in Rome seems to wear, but his was accented with gold embroidery that caught the sun. His face was painted red. Your float rumbles down the streets for what seem like hours. You're a little surprised by the city. You thought Rome would be at least as spectacular as Athens, but it's dingy and decayed. The buildings look like military barracks, and perhaps they are. After half a century of civil war, Rome has evolved into a thoroughly martial society. All men are in the army and live in separate buildings from the women, so you're told. The women are said to live in similar barrack-like buildings, where they're expected to raise the next generation of soldiers. There's no room for art or poetry in this city. The longer you bump through its rough, unadorned, and wretched streets, the more angry you become. This dump of a society destroyed your Athens, your beautiful Athens, a city that was full of music and art, a city that sparkled at night thanks to your network of gas lamps. That city is gone. It's just a heap of ash now, a memory to be forgotten. The float stops. Soldiers climb up onto your platform and shackle the Athenians together. They lead you off the float and into a central square where you're corralled into some sort of colorful pageant along with all the Greeks from the other floats. You're arranged along a set of steps that act like risers, you think. You wonder darkly if a choir master will step forward and make you sing for the throngs of unwashed pouring into the square. You imagine it would be the first music they've ever heard. A bull is sacrificed, its thick blood left to pour out into the streets. You saw this kind of thing in the old days at Athens, but it has long since been considered a barbaric practice amongst civilized Greeks. The priests dig their hands through the bull's gory remains, searching for clues about the future. Birds are released into the sky. The priests do end up singing, but it seems to you an ugly, guttural song, well out of place in an age of harmony and mechanical pipe organs. The priests press their bloody hands on General Cultus, who stands stoically before them. They belch their ugly chants into his face as he looks up at the sky. He seems to draw on some external power. King Mithridates is cut down from his cross. He shrieks to life as the blood rushes painfully back to his hands and feet. You know that feeling, that painful feeling of being brought down from a cross. Mithridates can't walk, and soldiers drag him along the cobbles. The old king is silent, mostly, only yelping pathetically when a cobble digs into his legs or back. He's thrown before General Cultus. He doesn't even try to get up, but lies there on the cobbles, panting for breath, almost sobbing. The general moves his stony face down, so he's staring right into the old king's eyes. Cultus mounts Mithridates as though he were a horse. He puts his hands around the old king's neck and squeezes. Mithridates shudders. He flails and hits at Cultus, but his once mythical power is gone. His face goes blue. Then he goes limp. You've been unpacking crates for hours. It's night, and the glassless windows of the barrack-like building let in a crisp breeze. The whole place smells like black mold and decay, and you have to convince yourself to just breathe naturally. Who knows how long you'll be in this place? One of the oil lamps blows out. Olive oil. You have to physically fill the rough clay lamp from a jar. It feels so arduous compared to this simple flick of a knob that could light a whole room with bright gaslight back in Athens. Athens. It's best not to think of it. That life is over. You've left lives before, many lives. Each one is hard in its own way. But you were invested in this life, this one in Athens. You had a family, a business, friends. You spent 50 years building your life, and now that life is gone, along with your son. And who knows if your granddaughter survived her first flight in the Winged Victory. Gone. Everything gone. You have to just make a clean cut and move forward. But that seems impossible. Every time you unpack another tool, another machine part from the crates, it comes with flashes of memory. Memories of Persephone gleefully building her airplane. Memories of Daedalus when he was a little boy. Memories of carving out your place in your adopted world. If the Romans had made you a mere galley slave, or a slave in some coal mine, it would have been easier than this. At least it would feel like a different world, a clean break. But these tools, they are a constant reminder of your loss. The door bursts open, and three soldiers storm in, their stolen Athenian rifles pointing to the ceiling. A group of scruffy-looking prisoners follow. You recognize many of them. They're Athenians. One of them was a machinist at your refinery, but the rest are just ordinary citizens you recognize from the streets. A giant of a man slumps in, covered in a sack so you can't see his face. Then, General Septimius Cultus steps through the doorway. He's still wearing the armor from his triumph, and the red paint on his face hasn't quite washed off. He's an attractive man, short but attractive, with a cleft chin, a perfect tan, and curly gray-black hair that makes him look like a maturing celebrity. He looks tiny, standing next to the man in the sack. "I brought you a present," Cultus says. "These are your first batch of slaves. Make sure they work hard, and if any slack off or get sick, let me know." You nod, sadly. "I expect guns," he says, caressing the barrel of a rifle held by a soldier near him. "I want 100,000 of them." 100,000, you say. "That's too many. It took everything I had just to build 1,000 in Athens." "You'll have many more slaves than you had at Athens."
"I never use slaves."
Cultus chuckles to himself.
"You're soft, aren't you? You Greeks think you're better than us Romans, more enlightened. Well, now you're in chains, and you work for us. And you're going to have to put your stuffy morals aside and get used to managing slaves, because you're going to have a lot of them. Now, we need 100,000 rifles. Do whatever you need to do."
I see. Of course.
"You Greeks are smart. I've seen your machines. Why don't you build a machine that makes rifles? That should speed things along."
I suppose that I could do that, but...
"And I want something special. I want a gun that fires multiple rounds. Can you do that?"
"What do you mean by multiple rounds?"
I don't know, put a bunch of guns together and rotate them on a crank or whatever you Greeks dream up. I don't care, but I want a gun that repeats.
Oh, I see. Yes, I'll see what I can do.
And I want an airship.
An airship?
Yes. You built a flying machine. Everyone saw it. I want one, but bigger.
How much bigger?
Bigger. I want it big enough that I can walk inside. As big as this building. And put a bunch of those crank guns in it. And your famous flamethrowers. And I want a glass dome at the bottom so I can watch the battle.
You scratch your head. Your mind is already darting through the impossible details. But you're also worried. What battle is he talking about?
I want you to build me ships, too. Big ships. Just like those ships you used at Athens. The ones that run on coal and have round wheels on each side.
Paddle wheelers?
Yes, paddle wheelers. But I want them big.
How big?
Big enough to transport 1,000 soldiers each, not including the crew. And I want 100 of them. No, 200. And we need ships for animals and supplies, too.
This is a staggering request. You feel dizzy. The logistics, the materials, the number of workers, slaves, the facilities. You have to sit down. How long do I have to do this?
5 years, and I want it to be perfect. And I'm going to be giving you other requests along the way, so just be warned. I'm a very needy person.
You scratch your head. 5 years. This will take tens of thousands of slaves, maybe more. And it will require some serious administration. And then there's the question of your ability to draft such machines. You aren't the inventor your granddaughter was. She was the one that figured out most of the technical problems for lighting Athens with gas, to say the least of the Winged Victory. And this airship General Cultus wants, it sounds much more complex than the Winged Victory. I'm going to need help, you say.
You'll have all the slaves you need. You can have all of Greece for all I care.
No, it's not that. I need someone who can help me manage all this. Someone who is an inventor. Someone who I can, you know, bounce ideas off of.
General Cultus kicks the giant in the sack, who falls to the ground. The man inside yelps. You recognize that yelp. That's what he's for.
The general has a glint in his eye. And a devilish smile.
Go on, open it.
You lean down and untie the sack.
It's Mithridates, your king.
His face is bloody and bruised, and his long white beard is filthy. But he's alive.
Are you happy?
I don't understand. I thought, I saw with my own eyes.
You thought I killed him? No, I just choked him a little until he passed out. I had to appease the crowd.
But why? Why is he here?
The general bends down, so he's eye level with you. You think I'm a mindless barbarian because I'm a Roman. Mithridates is the most intelligent man alive, more intelligent than you, I'd wager. Perhaps even more intelligent than Persephone? If you're going to hit your quota, you're going to need him.
The mention of your granddaughter makes your heart skip a beat. General Cultus has done his homework. You look down at Mithridates. His cheeks are swollen, giving him a deceivingly thick face that should be sallow from malnutrition. His eyes try to focus on you and the general, but keep rolling back in his head. The poor old man is exhausted.
Make sure no one knows he's alive. Keep him hidden here. I don't want the old man seeing the light of day, you understand?
Yes, General.
And and make sure you feed the poor old wretch.
Yes, General. Is there anything else? He stands up and walks towards the door.
Yes, I want the airship to take off and land from the water.
General Septimius Caltus and his soldiers storm out of the workshop, leaving you with the Greek slaves and King Mithridates lying on the floor. You lean down and cradle Mithridates' head in your one good arm.
Water, quick, you say to one of the Greek slaves, and she runs off.
The rest look stunned to see the old king. Many have only seen his face on coins.
Are you all right? Are you badly hurt?
You say, a bit sheepishly. You've seen him many times when he visited Athens, but never up this close, and never this fragile. He was always the picture of a king, tall, muscular, proud.
The poison, it never worked.
What do you mean? What poison?
After the battle, I took poison from my ring. It didn't work. Too stale.
You feel his forehead. He's feverish.
It's a good thing the poison didn't work. Then we wouldn't have a king.
He looks into your eyes for the first time. His pupils are quivering with fever, but there seems to be some clarity within them, revealing the mind of a philosopher. You motion to the Greeks in the room to kneel down.
Your empire is here. You have subjects in all of us, and I believe there are many tens of thousands of us here in Rome. We will follow you, even if it's in secret.
Mithridates lifts his old hand from the sack and puts it around your arm. His hand is strong. The old king is notorious for living off the land more than in palaces. He is a king and an inventor, but he is also a survivalist, a hunter, and a horseman.
I will give you your freedom, he says. Somehow.
He leans back and closes his eyes, the fever taking him away.
Time goes by. Mithridates recovers from his fever and is soon back to good health. At around 6'2", he towers over the other Greeks who visit the workshop, or what everyone secretly calls the throne room. As for yourself, you notice your own ancient body deteriorating rapidly. Your hair turns from gray to white. The flashes of pain have become more frequent, and there seems to be a chronic pain in your abdomen. Doctors have no reasonable diagnosis, and you can't help but remember Napoleon dying from stomach cancer. Still, you must go on. You are the de facto administrator, although everyone knows Mithridates is the true mastermind. And here Mithridates proves to be an excellent administrator, as well as a brilliant scientist. He's patient and listens to your ideas intently, only inserting his own improvements with the utmost tact, so you almost feel as though you came up with the ideas yourself. You have the advantage of knowing a branch of the future.
You know what technology is possible. But still, this world seems to be passing you by. Within a couple years, your slave crew of 200,000 Greeks have created what looks like an industrial city on the bank of the Tiber, right in the heart of Rome. Whole neighborhoods are cleared out for the industrial zone, and factories spume out billowing clouds of smoke that create soupy smog that lingers between the seven hills. You hack up black phlegm every morning. But at least, thanks to Mithridates, your factories are on schedule. General Cultus keeps adding to your list of inventions. His creativity in Warcraft is endless. Cannons that fire balls of explosive flame. A diving bell with a drill for sinking enemy ships. Armored vehicles that mimic the Testudo formation. Pole axes that second as rifles, iron-cleated boots and gloves for scaling walls. It seems that every day brings a new set of ideas, and you find yourself managing his expectations with the same intensity as you manage 200,000 Greek slaves. The Roman general's anger is legendary, and if he doesn't get what he wants, it often results in someone's death. The crowning achievement of your industrial prison is the airship, and this is Mithridates' pride and joy. Sometimes you wonder if he uses it as some sort of cathartic replacement for his lost empire. Thankfully, the Romans salvaged your blueprints for the Winged Victory. But to scale it up from a small two-seater built from balsa wood to something resembling a B-17 bomber is a serious business, especially since General Cultus wants the plane built entirely from steel. You regret saying it was possible. Mithridates' designs are impressive and entirely unique from anything you've ever seen. The plane is an avenue that was never taken in your world, but one that is extremely compelling. His charcoal drawings show a long steel funnel brimming with crank guns and firebombs. There are two long wings on each side, a series of six small engines dot each wing. The pilot sits in a dome in the front of the airship, while General Cultus will sit on a cushioned chair in the center of the plane, where he can look down on the battle from a dome. He will be able to give signals to the officers below using bright chemical flares developed by the genius of Mithridates. These will be released from the tail of the plane, following a pattern similar to Morse code. You and Mithridates call the airship the Dragonfly. The Greek quarter at Rome reminds you of something from World War II, something like a factory complex filled with Jewish slaves, or perhaps something more urban like the Warsaw Ghetto. The whole complex is surrounded by walls. Supplies are coveted by extremely corrupt Roman soldiers. These soldiers siphon off whatever they can, enriching themselves and their families, while your Greeks starve. It's common to see stick-like people in the factories, leaning against the machines, too exhausted to work. The Roman soldiers are also brutal, and this isn't a learned brutality like those of Nazi soldiers. The Romans are inherently savage. Their ancient lust for blood sports spills out into the arena of the streets, the alleys, and the factory floors, where they kill at their leisure, drawing out the suffering of their Greek prey like a child slowly killing a bug. long past the frivolity of an uncomfortable early experience. The Roman soldiers kill with the concentration of a devout hobbyist at work. They pick their prey and expertly stage the prearranged scene to the terror of Greek onlookers. Because such scenes are so common, the soldiers often look bored if the killing happens too soon, or if it doesn't meet their ever-increasing creative standards. The brutality of the camp, coupled with starvation and hopelessness, inevitably leads to sparks of rebellion. In the early years, these were disorganized and spontaneous, but as the years go by, a highly structured Greek resistance evolves. This resistance targets the most corrupt and savage Roman soldiers, killing them in their sleep or in dark alleys. The resistance collects weapons, stockpiling them in attics and sewage drains. They sabotage the factories and weapon stockpiles. They even hunt down powerful Romans at night and assassinate them in their hilltop citadels. The Greek resistance has become so notorious and effective that many Roman senators screamed to have the Greek quarter burned to the ground and every Greek sacrificed in some sort of Aztec-style slaughter. But General Cultus always prevails against them. He is the most powerful man in Rome, having ended the Civil War, consolidated Italy, and reconquered Greece. All the key power brokers are in his pocket, and his pockets are deep. General Cultus is perhaps the most psychopathic Roman you've ever met, and that's saying a lot. In fact, he's so self-absorbed that he doesn't even seem to care about the city of Rome. He treats it as yet another pawn in his game of power politics. It's a source of recruits, and some of the best recruits in the world. The Romans are hardy and even eclipse the Spartans in their ferocity. But on the other side of the coin, there are the Greeks and their brilliance for invention and industry. The Greek armaments are a force multiplier, and he covets these armaments as though they were his own children. There have been many times when you've begged General Cultus to call off his savage Roman soldiers and give the Greeks proper rations. The Greeks could double, triple their production if they could only work in a safe environment and with enough to eat. It staggered you for a long time that he didn't see this logic, but eventually you came to realize that the suffering of the Greeks and the conflict between them and the Romans was all part of his plan. Everything General Cultus touches seems to break apart in conflict, but somehow it's always General Cultus that is the one who benefits.
"I'm going to have Mithridates killed," General Cultus says to you one day in early spring. You were just going through the month's catalogue of armaments, listing off the number and quality of new weapons, when he dropped this bomb. He said it off the cuff, dreamily, as though it were something that had been percolating for a long time and finally floated up to his conscious mind. Of course, that's never the case with Cultus. His brain works like a machine that calculates power. "What do you mean?" you say, dumbstruck. "He's done his job. I needed him to organize the Greeks and give me the best weapons possible. But now they're done." It's been 5 years. You always knew this was your target year, but you don't have everything ready on General Cultus's list. It would take at least another 2 years to complete everything. General, you say. I don't want to sound argumentative, but we haven't completed our tasks.
Give me a breakdown of everything we have, but keep it high level.
Yes, General, you say, searching through your documents. You find an overview list with the main labor divisions and what they're working on. We have 80,000 rifles. We have 71 troop transporters and 86 warships. 20 supply ships, all steam-powered paddle-wheelers. There are many more of each ship ready to be laid, but they won't be ready until next year.
That's fine, General Cultus says. Go on.
We have repeater guns, 98 of them.
Good.
And we have 1,082 cannons, all mounted on the decks of your warships.
What about the big guns, the howitzers, you call them?
We have just 10 of them. General Cultus frowns in disapproval.
Firebombs?
Yes, we have lots of those. Mithridates was very helpful in that department. We have over 10,000 firebombs. Some can be shot from cannons, others from howitzers, and still others from... Well, you just drop them from the dragonfly.
Dragonfly?
Sorry, that's what Mithridates and I call your airship.
Ah, it's ready?
Ready for testing. We've never taken it up. It should work, but we don't know yet.
When will you test it?
We can test it now, today, if you like. We've just had other priorities, you know.
Test it now.
Okay, but...
I said test it now. I don't care what else you have on your list.
Very well, we'll test it now. But I'm going to need Mithridates, so please don't kill him.
I make no promises.
Another thing. I want you to create a list of names. Greeks who we need to take with us to battle. To battle? What do you mean?
Maintenance workers. Greeks who can fix things while we're on campaign.
I see.
You choose not to tell Mithridates about his imminent death and your protestations against it, but instead share with him that your priorities have changed and he'll now be able to focus all his efforts on the dragonfly. You and Mithridates climb into the dragonfly along with a skeleton crew of Greeks, only what's required to keep the airship flying. Mithridates is the pilot, and you sit as his co-pilot in the glass dome at the front. There is a Greek engineer running the engine at the back, and another two of your brightest mechanics will test all the many exposed pipes, gears, and cranks that crisscross the interior of the airship. These will be hidden behind panels when the plane is filled with gunners and bombers, but for now, the mechanics need easy access to the guts of the airship.
Wing one,
Mithridates says into his speaking tube. He cranks a lever and you hear a mechanical crimp from the hull and feel the whole airship heave.
Wing one's a go,
comes the voice of a mechanic through your tube.
Wing two,
Mithridates says. He runs through each of the four wings, making sure each are able to pivot individually.
"Engine go,"
he says, and the mechanic at the rear of the plane cranks up the gas-powered engine. There's an incredible blast of noise from the rear of the plane, far louder than the Winged Victory. It sounds more like one of the great engines in a weapons factory.
"Engine is go,"
comes the mechanic's voice through the tube. You have to press it into your ear to cancel out the roar of the engine.
"Throttle,"
Mithridates says, and presses against a lever. Amazingly, the engine grows even louder as gas is poured into the cumbersome engine. There's a lurch and the dragonfly leaves the dock. Mithridates maneuvers the wing so that the dragonfly's center of gravity forces it into the middle of the Tiber. He then levels out the airship, pointing you downstream. There, on your right, on the north bank, is the Greek quarter with its many factories still pumping out soot from their long brick chimneys. All along the bank can be seen curious Greeks, and the crowd is growing. You also notice Romans along the south bank of the Tiber. They're gobsmacked. The Greeks are used to new inventions, especially the Athenians, but the Romans have only just begun to witness any form of technology more advanced than a sword.
"Throttle at 75,
Mithridates says, and presses the lever down even further. The engine roars like a pride of lions, and the dragonfly lurches forward. You realize this is the first time you've truly been in a plane in this world. Yes, you and Persephone developed the Winged Victory, but she was the only one who ever flew it on that unspeakable day.
"Throttle at 100%, adjusting wings for takeoff."
The engine is as loud as a bomb, and you feel your back press into the chair. The dragonfly crashes along the choppy waters of the Tiber. Everything rocks and bumps and shudders so much that you feel like the whole contraption will fall apart. This is the ancient world. They shouldn't have this kind of technology. The dragonfly leaves the water, and the shudders stop. You're pointed up towards the clouds. As the ship levels out, chopping at the thinning air, the sound of the engines coos into a gentle hum.
"Systems report,"
Mithridates says into his speaking tube.
"Xanthippus here.
All injection lines are good. Fuel tank is good. Connectors are good."
"Thank you, Xanthippus. Fortokius."
"Ah, this is Fortokius. The wings are doing great. Everything holding up well. I'm just oiling the crankshaft for Wing 3. It was a bit rough pulling out."
"How rough?"
"Nothing major, my king. We can keep going. I'll just keep working on it tonight when we're back."
"Thank you, Fortokius."
"Andronike?" Yes, this is Andronike. The engine's eating up a bit more gas than I'd like. I'm testing it now."
"Do you want us to return?"
No, my king."
"Very well. What do you think it is?"
It's nothing. I'm adjusting the intake now. Nothing serious. Keep flying."
"That's everyone."
You look down and see Rome below. It's a sprawling city that covers the countryside like a filthy oil rag. Parts of it are hard to see thanks to the smog. Even the river is darkened by pollution. You can see the pipes along the banks spewing out sewage and old slag runoff from your factories. Barges run up and down its length, hauling coal, iron, wood, and grain. And there is the shipyard, full of what looks like whale carcasses, their iron ribs being riveted with plates of steel, their mechanical organs lowered in by crane. There's only one paddle-wheeler in the Tiber, next to the shipyard. A beautiful, sleek work of art in a storm of dark chaos. The rest of the ships are all down at Rome's port city of Ostia.
"So, what do you think?"
comes Mithridates' voice through the tube. It's an industrial cesspool down there. This is the first clean air I've breathed in years.
No, I mean, what do you think of the dragonfly?
Do we have enough fuel to get to Alexandria? Mithridates laughs, but his eyes look sad.
I thought of that too.
And no, Cultus made sure we only have enough fuel for a quick test. Next time, let's store a little something extra in some tins. Mithridates doesn't say anything, and you know he can't. He would never leave his people, and as dirty and filthy as Rome is, a small part of it is the only empire he has left. He taps the fuel gauge. It's almost empty.
Our taste of freedom is over, I'm afraid. Back to the slag heap.
I'm sorry, but your king has to die, General Cultus says. His slaves are fitting his black iron armor. You've come to hate his good looks, not out of jealousy, but because they lie to the world. He is such a monster on the inside, so ruthless, pathological, and yet people fawn over him, both men and women, mostly because of some twisted Roman superstition that says that physical attraction proves descendancy from the gods. I need him, you say. I can't do this without him. You can, and you will. He knows chemistry better than anyone. You want flares and bombs? You want poison-tipped bolts? He's the one true master. No one is better. True, but his recipes are being mass-produced. He's the only one with experience flying. Then someone will have to learn from him. But he knows the dragonfly better than anyone. You can't just teach one of your Roman soldiers to hold the controls and expect to fly it. It takes a deep knowledge. The dragonfly is an extremely complex machine. The most complex machine in this world. Someone will just have to learn, General Cultus says, and you can tell he's growing frustrated with you. That's dangerous, but today you're going to have to risk his anger. How? How will someone learn when you want us to mobilize within the week? You can do it. No, I can't, you say, wobbling your useless arm at your side. Then one of your engineers can do it. No, they can't. Would you trust a squire to fight like his master? Going into battle requires a warrior's heart, and that's what Mithridates has. No one else can command the dragonfly. General Cultus looks sulky and mad. It's not often that he allows a slave to challenge him, especially not when there are other slaves around. He hits one of them, and they all melt away, leaving his armor half untied. He approaches you and grabs you by the collar, pulling you down to his height. Mithridates has to die, and he will die, one way or another, at one time or another. So you won't kill him before the battle? Cultus pushes you away in disgust and recklessly ties his armor to himself. Do you have that list?
The list of Greeks? Yes.
You pull out the paper and hand it to him. He snatches it
and storms out of the tent, slapping it into one of his officer's hands.
"Go and collect these Greeks, now," he says.
"You, follow me,"
he says to you, without turning. You follow. There are soldiers everywhere in the field outside Rome, all dressed in their best parade uniforms, their helmets plumed with red frills that stand out against their black armor. You follow Cultus up the back of a grassy hill. You see, spread before you in the valley, thousands and thousands of soldiers in a scene that reminds you of Hitler's famous Nuremberg rally. You suddenly feel very self-conscious, standing among the officers, senators, and other nobility. You also have that tingling feeling that you're at the center of history.
We've been trapped for too long.
The gates of Mars have been open for hundreds of years, Cultus begins, speaking to the group. Through these gates, the Furies have made their home in our great city. But over the last few years, the Furies have grown bored, and in their boredom, they bring mischief to us. They play with us, filling the Greeks with venomous ideas. You all know someone who has been killed by them. Perhaps a friend who has been murdered in the streets. A family member guillotined in his bed. Now is the time. Now is the time that we rouse the Furies from their play and remind them who their true masters are. Now is the time we ready them for war. Bang the Titan skin drums, raise your black standards, and bare your chests so that the Furies may enter them. Priests, bring your sacrifices. Release the sacred birds, divine our course, and send the Furies ahead of us to Alexandria. The soldiers roar with approval, and the chant of Cultus, Cultus, Cultus fills the valley. The general lets this go on for some time, allowing his men to gorge themselves a little on his name before he continues.
Alexandria is the last great city to hold out against us. But don't let its wealth deceive you. The Alexandrians are a proud people who love their home. They will fight to keep it, and I have it on good word that they will bring to battle machines. But what I also know is that they hide behind these machines. They are no match for your bravery, your skill at killing, or your irresistible numbers. And unlike you mighty Romans, the Alexandrians fear the sight of blood. Cut off one of their heads and hold it high, and you'll find yourself scything the rest of their fear-trembling bodies at your leisure.
The Romans laugh.
You, Romans, don't have walls around your city. You don't need them. But the Alexandrians have built walls that could withstand the stampede of elephants. Fear not, Romans. We have something much greater than elephants.
Cultus turns and nods to one of his officers a ways down the hill. The officer, in turn, raises his arm and brings it down in a chopping motion. A howitzer lets out an enormous boom that flattens 100,000 Romans in the grass, all covering their ears. Your own ears ring, and your whole body is shaken from what feels like an earthquake.
We've been trapped.
It takes a while for the soldiers to find their composure. Their tight ranks are now loose and confused, and the valley is filled with whispers and chatter.
Romans, that weapon you heard just now is powerful enough to blast a hole the size of an elephant in any wall. You have 10 such weapons. They will fire relentlessly at Alexandria,
so there is not a moment of silence day or night. While you have to get used to noise, the Alexandrians will have to grow accustomed to death. The soldiers cheer for this, and the word cultus begins to fill the valley once more. This time, the general lifts his hand before the soldiers can build up the chant.
Romans, when we storm the city of Alexandria, do not be overcome by the storied wealth. There will be more of it than you can possibly carry with two arms. Do not despair. Drop off your load in the ships and return for more. But do not fight with each other over a woman or a gold chalice. There is plenty more in the next house. Let your jealous companions gloat over their hard-won treasure. You will soon walk past with a princess draped in shimmering gems.
The Romans again roar in approval. This time, Cultus lets them raise the sound of his name to a tribal boom of mesmerizing proportions. The chant goes on and on, resounding with religious zeal, the eyes of 100,000 souls filled with worship for a single man, filled with lusty dreams as though a god had promised them. Priests drag a bull draped in garlands before the savage crowd. One of them cracks its skull with a ceremonial sledgehammer, and it collapses on its front leg, stunned. Another priest slits the beast's throat, which explodes in blood. The priests go to work on the beast, like fiends, cutting it apart and revealing its organs. They raise these organs to the chanting soldiers and drop them into a tripod filled with hot coals so that the meat hisses and the smell of cooking flesh wafts through the valley. You can see the Romans salivate. Gorged on the sight of the blood and hungry for meat, the men's erotic and gory dreams of conquest are fueled to a feverish pitch. Their mouths are agape like hungry chicks ready for cultists to stuff carnage into their hot bellies. Their bodies shake for it. General Cultus raises his arms. It takes a full 5 minutes for some semblance of quiet to fill the valley.
You want a taste of the slaughter to come? Go into the Greek quarter and have your fill.
The men cheer and clamber over each other to race back to the city. You thought they couldn't get any more savage, but now they are practically orgasming in a feverish insanity, like hungry wolves released into a pen of rabbits. You turn and run down the hill as fast as you can. You have to get back to the Greek quarter. You have to raise the alarm before these savages kill everyone. There's a pain up your side, and you clutch it with your one good hand. It's too much, too intense. You collapse face down into the muddy grass. The last thing you see before blacking out are the hobnailed sandals of Roman soldiers running past you.
The carnage in the Greek quarter is devastating. There are bodies everywhere in its coal-blackened streets, and already the rats and stray dogs have begun to feed on them. The factories are eerily silent. You haven't heard this kind of silence here before. It's uncanny. You make your way back to your barracks as quickly as your sick body will let you. The hall is a mess. Blueprints and broken models are strewn about the floor. There's a body under a pile of papers, which is sopping up the blood like a sponge.
You throw off the papers. It's not Mithridates, but some unfortunate Greek off the streets who must have run in here hoping to escape death. There's still hope. You and Mithridates had an escape plan if something like this happened. A trap door under one of the desks. You kick at the straw rug and pull the handle, allowing the trap door to fling open. It's dark in the crawl space and musky.
Mithridates, are you down there? It's safe.
No answer. You light an oil lamp and shine it down into the darkness. Dust particles fill the orb of dim light. There are shapes moving, bodies.
Who's down there? Don't worry, I'm not a Roman.
Faces come into focus. Terrified faces. Men, women, even some children. Young children who were born into this hell.
Is King Mithridates down there?
No.
Do you know if he's alive? Did any of you see him?
I did,
comes the voice of a woman. She inches her way cautiously into the light. She's still wearing her worker's overalls, and her face is smeared with coal.
I saw him. I saw them drag him away through the streets.
They didn't kill him.
They might have killed him, but not then. Is it over? Is it safe to come out?
There aren't any Romans around, but I wouldn't say it's safe. Are you hungry?
The woman nods.
I didn't think I'd ever be hungry again.
You'll find some preserves over there, in the far corner under some rocks. There should be enough to feed the lot of you for a few days. But I'd recommend you leave this place tonight if you can.
And go where?
That I can't tell you. The army will be leaving soon, but the citizens will come here. They'll tear this place apart and probably do a much more thorough job than the soldiers.
There are guns here,
a man says, pulling up a rock in the corner.
Yes, guns and other weapons. Use them if you need to. Keep those kids safe.
There's no thank you, no goodbye, just a silence that's filled with sadness. You close the trap door and move the straw rug over it. Your mind goes to Alexandria. Will this be the fate of that great city?
Mithridates,
you say, and he gives you a big bear hug in the darkened cell. You can feel the boat rocking under your feet, and the only light emanates from a small, tightly riveted porthole. At least the cell is new.
How did you escape?
He says.
I should ask you the same question. I heard from one of the survivors that you were taken away by Roman soldiers.
Yes, yes, I was.
They put me in a cage wagon and brought me to the ships. There are other Greeks, the best and the brightest. They seemed to know exactly who to pick. The guilt flows through you. You helped General Cultus create that list of names. But what choice did you have? He was going to kill everyone, and at least you could save some of them. And you begged to have Mithridates on that list. You risked your own miserable life so he could live.
I guess we're going to war, you say, trying to change the subject.
Mithridates sits his old body in the corner and folds his hands.
By Zeus, what have we done?
What do you mean?
He bangs the steel hull of the ship with the ball of his old fist, making a sound like a gong.
We created this. Hundreds of them. Guns, armor, howitzers. This is an unholy army forged by Hephaestus himself. It's unstoppable. Oh, by Zeus, I wish that poison had worked. It would have been far better that I died rather than live to create the weapons that will doom my own people.
You walk over to the porthole and look out. The ships are spread out to the horizon. Great, hulking paddle wheelers that belch out coal dust like factories that roam the seas. Each ship is the size of the Great Eastern, that Victorian monstrosity that wouldn't be dethroned in size until the Titanic waddled its bloated steel gut into the sea. And there are hundreds of them. 100,000 Roman soldiers fill their black bellies, ready to be belched out into Egypt like a scourge, like an army from hell. Your mind roams to your granddaughter, Persephone, as it's done a million times before. Did she survive her first flight in the Winged Victory? Did she make it to Alexandria? You sit down next to Mithridates, hot tears rolling down his cheeks. He's right. You created this monster. And you, more than anyone else, more than Mithridates, more than your crack team of engineers. You brought the industrial age to the ancient world and handed it over to the masters of death.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. What you heard was part two of a three-part series called The Winged Victory. Please go on and listen to the next installment. If you enjoyed this show and want to hear more, there is a store with tons of time travel adventures just waiting for you to download. When you purchase a story from the store, you help support this show, and I really appreciate it. Writing time travel adventure stories for you is something I'd like to do for a living. And by building up the store, we can hope to get there one day. So please, visit twilighthistories.com, click on the store, and browse the titles. I'm sure you'll find something you like. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.
You've been listening to the Twilight Histories with Jordan Harbour.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.